I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. When I first saw the term BioBlitz, my first thought, well, maybe that's a vegan smoothie. But no, I'm going to tell you what I've learned. A BioBlitz is a crowdsourced counting of species in a very short span of time in a very specific area. A lot of people get involved in just counting stuff, living stuff. That's the bio part. Bugs, birds, reptiles, arachnids. I don't know. Anything bio, I suppose. Now, how would you conduct a BioBlitz high in the rainforest tree canopy? Do you put a lot of people up there, or should you? Well, somebody who can tell us about this and a whole lot more is Dr. Meg Laumann, also known as Canopy Meg. Laumann is an American biologist, an educator, an ecologist, executive director of the Tree Foundation, and a professor at the National University of Singapore, Arizona State University, and a university in Malaysia as well. And she pioneered the science of canopy ecology. And when I discovered her motto, "No child left indoors," I decided I already like her quite a bit. She's on the line with us. Meg Laumann, welcome to our show.
Hey, thank you so much. What fun.
You know, yeah, fun. Tell me about it. This is science. This is gravitas.
That's
this is
true.
Serious business. You need a furrowed brow.
Okay, I'll try.
What about that no child left indoors bit? That's kind of exciting.
You know, I was a single mom for quite a while, and I had two boys, and taking them out was one of the best things I ever did, and taking everyone else's kids out. And over the years, it just became important to me. And strangely, with COVID, now I think it's super important for parents to make sure their kids get a dose of nature and not just see everything on a two-dimensional screen. Don't you think so?
Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up with the documentaries and the National Geographic specials and Jacques Cousteau, and that was cool. But it has its limits, doesn't it?
Sure does. And the neat thing is these days you can even combine it with technology. You can use your iPhone to take pictures of things, or you can go out and study a sidewalk crack if you live in the city, or if you're lucky, you can get to a park somewhere and see all sorts of wild and wonderful things.
So this BioBlitz business, when was the last one you've been involved in?
Oh, my gosh, all the time. Well, a super-duper major one that I was involved with was just 2 years ago, and this was in Malaysia, where we counted over 1,500 things in 10 days, and it was so successful that we were able to now turn that area into a UNESCO World Heritage site, meaning it will never get logged. It will always be there for our grandkids and everybody else. So it was a really wonderfully productive BioBlitz, but I was involved in many, many over the years, especially in San Francisco, where we started a new app called iNaturalist, where people can go out and submit their pictures to a database and really help make a difference. So there's all kinds of cool things that kids can do, big kids or little kids, to help count species. And a lot of these are really informing scientists to help save species, which is super exciting.
So you said that this BioBlitz in Malaysia involved over 1,500 different things. Are you talking about separate, distinct species?
Yes, we are. And some of them had thousands of individuals of one kind, but I'm talking about 1,500 species. So that's exceptional. That's what the tropics is all about. Tropical rainforests, of course, are a hotspot for numbers of species. And in this case, I had recruited about 100 different scientists and volunteers to help with that effort. So it was a really, really big deal. And it was funded by a local philanthropist so that he could help conserve their rainforests in Malaysia, which I think was made it extra special for everybody to participate. In fact, we found a couple new species and they named it after the funder. So how do you like that? If you decide to go that direction, we might name something after
oh,
you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My vanity is kicking in right now. Well, Meg, if I were to sign up for a BioBlitz, I would not trust myself because I don't have the training. I would not trust myself to identify a species. So would somebody like me just be using my phone to take pictures?
Yes, two things. You would be either taking pictures or, in the case when you see more than 10 of something, particularly insects or plants, you can collect one and bring it back to the base camp. In the case of Malaysia, we had a lot of tables set up with microscopes and experts round the clock that were doing the identification. So the nice thing about a BioBlitz is volunteers are welcome, and they don't have to be experts. Otherwise, it would be pretty frustrating, wouldn't it, if we asked you to classify which kind of ant you collected. But the neat thing is that you can bring one back if you're part of a BioBlitz, and there would be a lot of good help both online and in person to help you contribute to the cause.
Now, it's kind of like taking a snapshot in a specific place at a specific time. That snapshot, though, can't necessarily always be representative of what's going around, all year round or at nighttime or different weather and what have you.
It is. It's like one photograph, and that is frustrating for science because if you had the BioBlitz on a rainy day, you might have an underestimate of species. If you miss out in the nighttime, you might miss a lot of insects that are active at night because they avoid getting eaten by birds. So there's a lot of nuances, and scientists have to put that into the mix, and maybe they have to do a repeat activity. Maybe they have to the fact that certain things are hiding in the bark crevices or other things are very secretive, and you've got to be there before sunrise perhaps to spot the things that are going to be hidden during the day. So there is more than meets the eye, no pun intended, to get a good documentation of species in the BioBlitz.
And in San Francisco, when this has been conducted, you say on multiple occasions?
Yes, we had a whole lot going on at the California Academy of Sciences when I was the chief of science there. We recruited and hired the team that founded this app called Naturalist and set up a lot of good partnership with National Geographic, with some of the different local parks. And now, of course, it's gone big time setting up partnerships with parks around the world, with parks around the country. And you can easily go online and download that app. Naturalist. You can also download new apps. The Smithsonian has one out that helps you identify plants and all sorts of wonderful and crazy things to help people become amateur naturalists is really what it's all about.
Well, let's get into the story of this eighth continent that's up in the trees that you have talked about so long and so well. And, of course, in your book, The Arbornaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees. You began, well, I talked about No Child Left Indoors. Can we talk about your childhood and how you became a naturalist in the first place?
I guess I was an outdoor child for sure. And I do talk about that in my book with some embarrassment because I think I was what's considered a geek as a kid, although I don't think we had that vocabulary when I was growing up in the 60s. But I laugh because my girlfriends were collecting Beatle records and I was collecting Beatles on pins and collecting bugs in my little nature under the bed shoe boxes. So yes, I was really an outdoor kid. I also grew up in a small town in a rural part of upstate New York. So I suppose my excuse is there wasn't a whole lot to do indoors as much as there was outdoors. And it gave me a lot of love for nature. And as a shy kid, that was really quite wonderful and special to be out there taking notes and learning all the birds and flowers. And I did have a couple of friends that helped me build a few tree forts, and I think every kid goes through that phase. My phase just lasted into adulthood.
Well, where did you build a rainforest fort? I mean, at some point.
I know. Well, yeah. Now we have some fabulous ones in the Amazon. We have this fantastic walkway over in Malaysia, thanks to the BioBlitz and the efforts, again, of fundraising there. So the more times we can get people in the canopy, including amateurs like yourself, the more chances we have to save it, because I think people learn how wonderful it is, just like the title of your show. It gives you a real sense of wonder.
Well, let's talk about the canopy specifically, because the way I understand it is that for many, many years, scientists, I'm talking about 100 years ago, there wasn't quite the appreciation that the life forms, the various species, are going to vary by elevation, not just as you go up a mountainside, but as you go up a tall old growth forest.
It's amazing. And I didn't know that either. When I was a kid, I thought the bottom of the tree was almost the same as the top. And what's incredible is that we now know that some 50% of species on the land part of our planet live in the tops of trees. And obviously, foresters never knew that in their heyday. Over the last 100 years, most foresters walked through the woods and looked at the trunk of the tree, and the only time they ever saw the top was if they cut it down, which is kind of why I had that analogy in the beginning of my book that, what, you know, if you went to a doctor and they just checked your big toe, you'd think something was really wrong with that doctor. And but when you analyze foresters looking at the bottom of a tree, you sort of wonder why somebody didn't scream and shout and say, hey, you're missing 95% of the tree, which is what turned out to be the case. And the coolest stuff really is at the top. That's where most of the biodiversity lives. That's where the flowers and fruits are. And, of course, everything that pollinates them or eats the fruits is going to be at the top as well.
So at the beginning of your professional career, when you decided we've got to be exploring here at the canopy, up high, how did that go over?
Well, first of all, I was scared myself. I have to admit, I thought I could train a monkey or do something, use binoculars, anything but try to figure out how to get up a tree. Because way back when, this was in the 70s, there weren't so many recreational climbing places. There weren't mail order catalogs to get all sorts of ropes and equipment. And so in the end, I really did try to kind of wiggle out of it. But my PhD advisor said, hey, wait a minute, you really have to get up there if you're going to look at what's going on. And so lo and behold, I joined the caving club at Sydney University, and they go down and I wanted to go up. They thought I was a hoot, but they did at least lend me their ropes, and I welded my first slingshot in out of a piece of metal, and I sewed a harness because I couldn't buy one anywhere. And so that launched my own career as an arbornaut, and then in turn I taught lots of other folks to do the same thing.
So you were in Australia, far from home, devising contraptions. This is kind of spunky of you, don't you think?
I know my mother hates hearing about it. I don't think she might ever read the book. It's probably still a worry to her, but it was pretty crazy. I was so honored to be in Australia. I had a full scholarship, so hence the inspiration to be there. And it was, as you probably read in the book, not a country that welcomed women to be scholarly, but I just kind of tried to keep with it quietly, and everybody at least loved my slingshot, so I got a lot of support from all the male graduate students about my field work at the time.
Well, they were probably intimidated to see you carrying it around.
They were totally, yeah. They absolutely loved that and helped me out a little bit, and that was really a godsend. But it was definitely a culture where women were not supposed to do PhDs. Never
well,
mind.
Explain if you will, what's the slingshot actually for?
Oh, great. Good question. So to get the rope up a tree, I had to figure out how to propel it, whereas cavers drop the rope down, which is very smart, and it goes with gravity. To get up a tree, you need to go anti-gravity, and so the slingshot allowed me to put a fish line over a branch and then in turn haul up a nylon cord that was middle-sized so that it was strong enough to then haul my climbing rope up and over what I hoped would be a sturdy branch. And then I would rig it and be ready to roll, and that allowed me to ascend into the canopy.
At some point, though, having gone up, you realized it sure would be convenient if we could also go over, right?
Yes, it did, and especially with my volunteers, some of whom were a little bit worried about dangling on this rope, and that did lead to building a canopy walkway in Australia as well. 1985 was the first one to date that serviced research and education in a big way. I'm sure many people have used the odd contraption or rickety tower here, there, and different parts of the world, but we really kind of refined the model of how to get people safely and carefully up in the canopy and can keep their sense of wonder at the same time.
So how long is a typical canopy walkway?
Gosh, they range from 100 feet to a quarter of a mile, and that's the wonderful thing. They can be adapted to different budgets, different forest types. We have a very small one here in Florida because the diversity of the trees is very low, whereas the quarter of a mile long walkway is in the Amazon, where we need to traipse through many, many different species to feel that we're getting some level of diversity that we might need for research purposes.
So how many canopy walkways do you suppose there are these days that are used for scientific purposes?
You know, I asked myself that question just last year, if you can believe it. Having built many of them, I was amazed that there are different groups of people building them. So over the years, we finally created an interactive map. You can go on my website, www.treefoundation.org, and look at this very neat computerized map that some students created and see that there are something like 75 operable walkways that allow the public to visit them, allow research to go on. And the great news is that some of them are really supporting conservation because they provide income to the indigenous people who live in the forest. And that income, of course, is much more sustainable than logging. So we're really excited about using the model of canopy walkways to help save forests.
Meg Laumann is with us, a biologist, an educator, an ecologist. She's author of The Arbornaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees. Meg, that phrase, eighth continent, can you justify that?
Oh, gosh. You know, when I first climbed a tree, and a handful of others did as well, we were so amazed that, again, I mentioned earlier that 50% of life might live up there, and yet we estimate we know less than 10% of those species. So it really is an eighth continent. It's an undiscovered portion of the Earth. It's very close to access, but yet somehow it's been overlooked. And we probably know more about Mars or the moon than we do about the tops of the trees in many cases. So lo and behold, we need to play catch up and really help explore this eighth continent before it gets cut down.
Well, let's go back to that 50% number. You're not talking about biomass. You're talking about different species. Is that what you're talking
about? I am. Yep. Millions of insects, thousands of birds, hundreds of mammals, extraordinary cool things like water bears, which you might have read about in my book, and things that we absolutely know next to nothing about. And the treetops is what we call a hot spot in biology for all sorts of things living up there.
So I'm presuming that these animals, these life forms, these insects, whatever they are, maybe even mosses and lichens, I don't know, that who knows? You're talking about this being a unique habitat for them. They dwell here and they don't dwell in other places.
Absolutely. And when I first started studying leaves in the canopy, sometimes I called it 50,000 shades of green. Every leaf is different. It's positioned differently. The light is different, the moisture, the age of the leaf in many cases, and what lives on the surface of the leaf and what eats the leaf, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this extraordinary complex, like the penthouses at the top and the basement at the bottom. And so all of these species are also very adapted to live in specific parts of the canopy. So it's quite an extraordinary lifestyle. And so many of those species never, ever see the forest floor.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned Bob Ballard. He's the guy who discovered the Titanic. And somehow you've been connected with him in this JASON project. This has to do with, I'm guessing, citizen science at some level?
It does. And I give Bob so much credit for enhancing my career in many ways. After Bob discovered the Titanic, he started what's probably the world's first virtual expedition program that he called the JASON Project after his wonderful hero, Jason and the Golden Fleece, because Bob's an oceanographer. And he looked around for a partner on land because he wanted to take these middle school kids on virtual expeditions, but not just undersea. He wanted to do something adventurous on the land. And lo and behold, he chose the forest canopy, and I became Bob's partner in that program for about a dozen years. We switched on and off between marine habitats and rainforest canopies. It was a blast. Bob taught me a lot about science communication. He's really very savvy on the air, and of course he's full of fun. We went to the Amazon and Panama and Belize, and of course we went to different undersea locations for his type of work. But it was a great, great experience, and each year we broadcast to millions of kids because it was virtual, and these were habitats that we could never share with millions of kids except virtually, and that's what made it so special.
So I get the gist that he took you on some occasion. You got to go down into the water, and you got to take him up to the top of trees?
A little bit of both, yes, but mostly he would be moderating me. I was at the top of the trees. Bob did not love insects. I have to laugh. He swatted them, to be honest, and I'm like, Bob, leave the biodiversity alone. And I'm very claustrophobic undersea, so we both mostly deferred to each other's habitats, but were very supportive along the way, and it was a fabulous experience. The best part being that you mentioned citizen science. You know, we engage teachers, we engage middle school kids, and a lot of those teachers and students followed up with me after the school expeditions and came with me in the summer on field trips and participated in some of my own expeditions, and obviously started BioBlitzes in their school, back to that earlier concept you mentioned on the show. So I think it really did spur a lot of people to get engaged in what lives in the trees around their neighborhood or their school or whatever kinds of habitat they could have.
You know, when I was growing up in the late 60s and 70s, when I was in grade school, we were taught a little bit about the environment, and we would get to see some fun movies produced for schools. And, you know, I remember seeing beavers and otters and lions and such. And one of the things that I have learned about kind of a gap in my own learning when I was young is that I kind of saw species as discrete entities. I didn't understand the interconnectedness of ecologies and ecosystems. And I think children today in schools are understanding this much. But my own children, sometimes around the dinner table, I've asked them, and they say, well, duh, Dad, these things rely upon each other. They don't use the word synergy, but they tell me that there's these interdependencies. And I'm wondering if with these citizen science projects, if that kind of messaging, that kind of education is more and more taken root.
I think so. And ecology is a relatively new field when it comes to colleges and education textbooks, etc. When you think about it, Darwin was so busy identifying most of everything and thinking a bit about evolution at the same time, but very few people were drawing the lines between all the species. And in fact, only when we start losing them do we recognize the importance of those interrelations. So it is pretty new, and good for your kids to be educating Dad. I think that the youth gets it, and I think they notice the connections, and hopefully they'll grow up to appreciate the importance of conserving the whole ecosystem. It's not good enough to save just the lion. You have to save the habitat of the lion, or else you're really in big trouble.
Well, Meg, I've just delighted in having a chance to visit with you, and the idea of Arbonaut is where I want to conclude our conversation. That's obviously tying it into sort of epic stories from the ancient world of, you know, other people out on their expeditions, right? Can you tell me that adventure is the right carrot to dangle for kids?
I think so. Let's face it, most of us always love telling a story of climbing a tree when we were young. And I think we did, of course, evolve from primates that lived in trees. So hopefully everybody has a little bit of inspiration and enthusiasm for climbing a tree. I love the fact that astronauts explore outer space and aquanauts explore undersea. And so why not have arbornauts exploring the treetops, especially because so many other things are living there. We really need to give it a fair bit of attention in the next decade or so if we do hope to conserve our forests and keep that biodiversity for the next generation.
Could you leave us with one of the more recent stories of some animal, some bug, something that you learned that opened your eyes and you said, I didn't know that?
Well, I'll just leave you with one very cool story, but part of my interest is getting more inclusivity in tree climbing, because a lot of field biology is usually considered to be for some kind of you know, athletic type. And so I had a project with kids in wheelchairs learning to climb trees, which was very exciting. And lo and behold, one of my girls in the wheelchair, Rebecca, discovered a new species of water bear and got to name it and publish it. And it just shows you that kids where you might not envision them having the will and the wherewithal can do anything if they have the enthusiasm. So I give a shout out to any young person. You too can be an Arbornaut if we can work together and figure it out.
Meg Laumann, biologist, educator, ecologist, and we've been speaking with her about her latest book, The Arbornaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees. Meg, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Back when I was a kid, a tree was just a big plant that puts roots down into the ground and shoots its branches out toward the sky and it leafs out and all of that. Lately, though, we've begun to think of trees more completely as ecosystems and, as we've just heard, as maybe up in the canopy, a continent unto itself. And now we're going to hear another voice who also understands trees as vast ecosystems. He looks closely at oak groves and other forested areas as conglomerations of interconnected life. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. The most important tree in American forests may just be the mighty oak. That's an argument made by Douglas Tallamy, author of The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. He and I got talking about oak trees, but before we got there, we had to talk about insects and birds and other things. Turns out that whatever eats the oak is just as important as the oak itself.
You know, when I say they're the most important trees, there are four things every landscape needs to be accomplishing ecologically. One of the most important things is to support the food web around that landscape. In other words, to support all the other life forms. It's plants that are capturing energy from the sun and turning it into food, and then they pass it on, and that's what allows the animal life to exist. And the more species you have in an ecosystem, the more stable it is, and the more ecosystem services it produces, which, of course, support us, but it supports everything as well. So we want plants that are going to pass on as much energy as possible, and oaks do that better than any other plant genus. And in terms of passing on energy, there is no creature better at doing that than caterpillars. I should say creatures. We have up to 14,000 species of caterpillars in North America. Well, oaks support, the latest count is 952 species of caterpillars, which is far, far more than any other plant genus. So in terms of supporting that food web in your yard, there's nothing that comes close to oaks. But oaks also are great at sequestering carbon, and we need to do that on every landscape. We need to manage the watershed, and oaks have wonderful root systems that do that better than most other plants. The only thing they're not superior at is supporting complex pollinator communities, and that's because oaks are wind-pollinated. Although there's recent evidence that a number of our pollinators do use oak pollen, they just don't move it to the female flowers and they don't actually pollinate. But three out of four of the landscape goals are accomplished by oaks better than any other plant genus, so that's pretty good.
Well, I want to go back to that comment you made about how many caterpillars will feed upon oak trees. You also say that most insects have become very good at eating a few plants, but are completely unable to eat most plants. This tells me that insects are specialists.
That's right. The insects that eat plants, at least 90% of them are highly specialized. And I could make an argument that they all are highly specialized if you look at the plants they cannot eat. So even our most generalized insects can only eat maybe 7% of the plants that are available to them, which means 93% are unavailable to them because they're so specialized on what they're able to digest.
So
the true specialists are eating, you know, way less than 1% of the plants that are available to them. And then, you know, the monarch butterfly illustrates that beautifully. You can have any kind of plant you want in your yard, but unless it's a milkweed, you will not support monarchs. And 90% of the insects that are out there are just like the monarch.
So it stands to reason from all that you've just said that with fewer oaks and all of these caterpillars specializing, to a great degree in oak trees. You limit the oaks, you limit the population of those caterpillars, and the chain goes on down in the cascade, and then you have fewer caterpillars, I guess, for what? For birds?
Well, birds are what I typically talk about because people care about birds. But there are so many things that depend on insects and caterpillars in particular. And, you know, it's the numbers that really are astounding. It takes thousands of caterpillars to make one clutch of birds. I always use chickadees as an example because we've got good data on chickadees. There's actually data on a number of bird species. 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to get one clutch of chickadees to the point where they leave the nest. And then the parents continue to feed them caterpillars another 21 days after they leave the nest. But they're flying all around, so nobody's counted those. That's tens of thousands of caterpillars to make one clutch of a bird that's a third of an ounce. That's 4 pennies worth of bird. And that's one pair of birds. You want a community of that species. You want a number of different bird species in your yard. So the number of caterpillars necessary to sustain bird populations in your neighborhood is astounding. And when we landscape with plants like eucalyptus or like crepe myrtle or all these other plants from Asia that are producing essentially no caterpillars, and we don't have to wonder why we've just lost 3 billion breeding birds in North America.
So are birds also specializing for their part? I'm wondering if they're going to be picky about their caterpillars.
Not really. There are caterpillars they avoid. They don't like hairy caterpillars, unless you're a yellow-billed or black-billed cuckoo that specialize on hairy caterpillars. But most birds don't like hairy caterpillars. Birds don't like distasteful caterpillars. So, you know, we want to save the monarch, but not because it's a valuable part of the food web. They don't taste very good. But birds love those little green inchworms and unprotected non-hairy caterpillars, and they will eat thousands of them every day.
So now we are already several degrees of separation away from sunlight. And I just want to review this, because if we talk sunlight going down to the oak leaf, the photosynthesis, the leaf can grow, the caterpillars can eat the leaves, the birds can eat the caterpillars. This is a fascinating tale. And I have read where you have talked about the idea that it's great for humans to be feeding birds, but the birds really have got to have the insects too.
So you're talking about actually putting out seeds
for
the birds. Yeah, no, that's right. Many people think that if you fill your bird feeder, you have done your job. And of course, that helps. It helps for birds primarily in the wintertime that don't migrate, because nearly all of them eat seeds. Not all of them, but most of them eat seeds during the winter. But typically, it's not their entire diet. So, for example, that chickadee that doesn't migrate, 50% of its diet remains insects, even in the wintertime. The golden-crowned kinglet, which ought to migrate but doesn't, it still eats caterpillars all winter long, even as far north as Maine. It's still finding those caterpillars that are spending the winter just sitting on branches. So seeds are great and help an awful lot of birds. But when it comes time to reproducing, most baby birds cannot eat seeds. So that's even the seed eaters have to switch to insects. When I say most, I mean most. 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. And again, most of those are caterpillars.
Yeah, what is that phrase from E.O. Wilson about the kind of the engines of all life? You know, it's like the small things that make the world go round. I don't know. I don't have it verbatim.
Insects are the little things that run the world. That is a quote from E.O.
The insects in the winter are available to the birds?
Yes, they are. If you were to climb an oak tree in the wintertime and come back down, you'd probably find caterpillars on your shirt. And I've done this, and I've always been surprised. What are they doing there in the middle of the winter? There's no green leaves for them to eat. They're simply sitting there. That's how they spend the winter. They look like sticks themselves. When it gets cold, they shrink a little bit. And when it gets warmer, they swell a little bit. But they're simply spending the winter. They're protected by proteins that protect their cells from freezing. So it's like antifreeze, and the cells don't burst. And that is what these birds are foraging. You watch your oak tree or even other trees in the wintertime. You'll see little birds running around the branches, and it looks like they're eating things. And they are. Bernd Heinrich is the one that figured this out. He actually opened the crops of a number of birds, particularly golden crowned kinglets, in January in Maine, and they were filled with caterpillars.
Wow.
So it's a big surprise to a lot of entomologists, but they spend the winter there, and the only thing we can think of is that they are there ready to go when those leaves come out. So if they spent the winter as an egg, they would have to hatch, and then they'd be very tiny. These things are nearly fully developed caterpillars, and they just have to eat a little bit before they complete their development in the spring. And that's what the birds are depending on.
You know, the oak story as providing food for birds, I would have gone first to the whole story of acorns. It shows you how little I know about birds and insects. But there are birds that also are very happy to get their beaks on those acorns.
There are many birds that depend on acorns. And sure, that's the obvious choice. Acorns are, you know, it's a wonderful source of food for birds and a number of mammals. But turkeys eat acorns and the number of woodpeckers, the acorn woodpecker specializes on acorns. But titmice and nuthatches and red-bellied woodpeckers and flickers. But jays have a really interesting relationship with acorns. And this, I'm talking about jays all over the world. That lineage evolved about the same time that oaks evolved in Southeast Asia. It was about 60 million years ago. So they've been together a long time. And it's a wonderful mutualism because jays depend on acorns for winter food. But they'll take acorns and fly up to a mile from the parent tree. And then they tap it below the surface of the soil. And the idea is they're going to go find it later on in the wintertime. But their memory is far from perfect. It's kind of like mine. They only remember where they put one and out of four acorns. And they can bury, you know, over 4,000 acorns per jay each winter. So they end up planting at least 3,000 new oak trees every year as far as a mile away from the parent tree. And that has allowed the genus Quercus oaks to move faster than any other tree genus in the world, that relationship with jays.
So it's not just that the birds are dependent upon the food provided by the tree, but the trees are dependent upon the birds for their expansion.
Exactly. And that has paid off a number of times, particularly when the glaciers came down and pushed oaks all the way down into the Gulf Coast states or even down into Central America. When the glaciers receded, oaks were the first trees to return because those jays were moving the acorns far faster than any other type of seed.
Some of the greatest concerns I've had in recent years as I've thought about the world and our situation is that so many of these processes are so much slower than the change we are inflicting on the world. And so we can make an abrupt and cataclysmic change, whereas an oak tree, man, that can take a long time to grow. They're slow in their growth, aren't they?
They don't grow as slowly as people think, but they live a long time. So the generation of an oak tree is quite long. The average lifespan of an oak is 900 years. There's 300 years of growth, 300 years of stasis, and 300 years of decline. And during each one of those periods, they're delivering unique ecological contributions to the landscape around them. So you're right. We humans are changing things faster than plant and animal populations have the chance to adapt to those changes. That is a very serious problem.
Well, I'm thinking about the old adage that's attributed to China, the idea the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. And then I'm going to bring that together in conjunction with 17 years before an oak tree can start producing acorns.
Yeah. But, you know, my wife and I moved into a property, a farm that was broken up, had been mowed for hay. So there were nearly, it was barren. There were very, very few plants there. And one of the first things we did was to plant a number of acorns. So we planted our oaks as acorns. It's now 20 years later, and they are real trees. You know, they're pushing 50 feet tall, circumference of 47 inches. They're not mature. They're making their acorns now. They're still babies as oaks, but they're full-size trees in terms of the way we appreciate landscapes. So the idea that oaks grow slowly comes from the fact that the first couple of years, it looks like they're doing very little. They put up their first pair of leaves, and then they sit there. What they're doing is building their massive root system that will sustain their growth the rest of their life. People make a mistake. Everybody, you know, they want to plant an oak, but They want to get as big an oak as possible. So they'll spend $3,000 get a 50-foot oak. But to transplant that oak, it has to be totally root pruned, which means it'll sit there for 10 years trying to rebuild that root system. Whereas if I had planted an acorn right next to that tree the same day, by the end of that 10 years, that acorn would be taller and far healthier because it would start with a very healthy root system. When you transplant a large tree like that, you have 50% chance of dying. So go with the cheap, the free option, and you'll have a much healthier tree.
So if a grove of trees can make for a better environment, a more stable situation there, let's also talk about this really interesting phenomenon where a tree like an oak will hang onto its leaves long after they've turned brown. And how does that figure into this story?
Yeah, that's a condition called marcescence. It's exhibited a lot by oaks, particularly in the white oak group. That's a particular taxonomic group. And it's very prominent in lower limbs or young trees. As a matter of fact, you can find leaves hanging on oaks in the white oak group up to about 18 feet tall. And after that, they start to fall off like normal leaves do. And they'll hang on there all winter long. So people wonder, what is marcescence all about? And the leading hypothesis is that it was an adaptation to protect the buds of that tree against browsing from the large mammals that used to inhabit the world. We're just talking about North America, but there's a wonderful picture on the web of the large Pleistocene mammals that used to be in Mexico alone. And we're talking about three species of mammoths, the giant sloth, and a slew of other really large creatures that were browsers, just like the white-tailed deer. And that means they're snipping off the buds of trees, particularly during the wintertime. So the idea is that if the oak surrounds its new buds with the leaves from the previous year, which are not palatable, they don't taste good, very little nutrition in them, then it's not an attractive place for these mammals to feed. And you might think, well, it's a long time since those mammals have been here, but it's not a long time. It's less than 10,000 years ago that we had these big mammals. And they were around an awful long time, and certainly the oaks have not had a chance to change that valuable adaptation. What's really interesting is that marcescence, again, goes up the tree about 18 feet, and that was the maximum reach of that giant sloth. Couldn't get any higher than that, so why bother to hang on to your leaves above that? It's good support for that hypothesis.
So once those leaves actually do come down, though, let's start telling the story about how important oaks are to the soil. There's so many facets to this.
Yeah, I call oak leaf litter the most valuable type of leaf litter because it lasts longer than the leaf litter produced by maples or birches or tulip trees, which barely make it through a single season. But a single oak leaf can take 3 years to break down. And that's valuable because it forms a blanket on the soil. And that's exactly what the soil biota, all the creatures that live in the soil, require. All the soil creatures demand moisture. So they like high humidity. They've got to retain moisture in the soil. When you cover the soil with a blanket of oak leaves, you're protecting them from erosion, from heat, from the sun, from drying out, which is critical. There are more animals in the soil than there are above the soil, believe it or not. Now, they're all tiny, but they're there literally by the millions. And if the soil dries out, they cease to exist. And all those animals it's the animals in the predators that are eating them, are detritivores. They're the things that are turning over those old leaves. They're breaking them down, returning the nutrients to the soil so that the roots can take them up again the next year. And that's true for any type of leaf litter. We're starting to think of leaf litter in the way we've been thinking about rainwater for the last several years. You want all the rain that falls on your property to stay on your property. You don't want it to run off. And you want it to infiltrate and recharge the water table underneath your land. Same thing with leaf litter. You want all the leaves that fall on your property to stay in your property so they can break down, protect the soil on your property, and return the nutrients that were used by the trees in your property that year. So when you rake up your leaves and burn them or put them out to the curb as if they were trash, you're depriving your trees of the nutrients that they need.
So you're going to have to unriddle me something here, which is there's this conventional wisdom among gardeners that the leaf litter can be a problem because it houses, you know, spaces for pests to persist over the winter. And so, I can't tell you how many times I've read, get rid of the leaf litter. What's your answer to, aside from what you've just told me, that it helps to regenerate and provide habitat for, how do you mitigate the idea that you might have some kind of an apple worm lurking there and hanging around?
Oh, there's an awful lot to unpack with that question. Most of the horticulture industry is based on the premise that our plants are decorations, and you don't want anything to eat your decoration. You want it to be perfect. But of course, you reflect back to our earlier conversation. If nothing eats that leaf, all the energy captured by from the sun stays in the plant, and you have you've just killed your food web because you're not passing any of it on. So if you walk up to a plant in your property and you see no part of that leaf or the plant eaten, that plant is not doing its job. So it's true. A lot of things spend the winter in the leaf litter. Remember all those caterpillars that are running the food web? Well, 94% of them drop from the tree and either burrow underground to pupate underground, or they spin a cocoon in the leaf litter that is under the tree. And when we take the leaf litter around, both those things become very difficult. So in order to have all of those moths, they're mostly moths, not butterflies, complete their development, you want to retain your leaf litter. Now remember, when you have all of these things that are going to eat your plants and your property, you also have the natural enemies that keep them in check. We talked about birds, but birds are natural enemies. When they're eating thousands of caterpillars a day, it's hard to find any caterpillars on your property. You know, I give talks and show pretty pictures of caterpillars and people say, well, I can't find them. Well, that's right. The birds have eaten them first, but you won't have the bird if you don't have those caterpillars. So don't worry so much about your plants being defoliated or clobbered by these animals. It's all part of the natural cycle. That includes herbivores, well, includes the plants, the herbivores, and the predators and parasitoids and diseases that keep all of those things in check. You want to build a landscape that is a complete ecosystem where all the trophic levels are there interacting with each other, and they'll do it on their own. They don't need input from you. That's the ideal landscape.
Well, would you talk a little bit about carbon sequestration? Because I understand the oak is particularly robust in its capacity to make this happen. I actually think the word robust is connected with the word oak, if you go back in the etymology far enough.
Ah, interesting. Hadn't thought about that. But yes, oaks are wonderful carbon sequesters. Of course, we want to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and that's what plants do. And they take the carbon from the carbon dioxide molecule, and they build their tissues with it. An important feature that most people don't recognize is that after they built their tissues, they continue to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, and then they start pumping it into the soil. So the soils around us are brown or black because of carbon that plant roots have deposited there over the eons. And soil scientists are now telling us that the soils around the world can store up to 7 times the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere right now if we put the carbon back in the soil. But every time you plow soil, every time you turn it over to construction of any kind, you're releasing up to 70% of the carbon that was stored there. So we've done that for centuries now, and the goal is to get as much carbon back in the soil as possible. So anything with large root systems is going to be good at that. But oaks, of course, you want dense tissues and you want a long-lived tree if you're looking to store carbon out of the atmosphere. And oaks do both of those wonderfully. Now, we've talked about oaks being large throughout this conversation, and most of them are. But I also want to emphasize there are a number of small species and dwarf species that are ideal for landscaping. So you can get those landscape attributes even if you have a small property. Because the first thing that goes through a lot of people's mind is, my property's not big enough for an oak, and I won't even think about it. But there's dwarf chestnut oak, dwarf chinquapin oak. There's a dwarf live oak down south. That are ideal for small properties. So they're actually ground cover oaks in the West. So oaks are not all of them are giants, and they can be used on smaller properties. There are 91 species of oaks in North America. So there are a lot of choices. But We have a few species of non-native oaks, like the English oak, that's Quercus robur, and Quercus sagittarius, the Chinese oak, which have been planted extensively because they make a lot of acorns, and they make those acorns quickly. The problem is that it's a Chinese oak. Far fewer creatures use Chinese oak compared to our North American oaks in North America. And the acorns they make are often too bitter for a lot of our wildlife to use. So, and now it has become invasive. It's moving on its own. You plant one, you get a whole bunch, and they're replacing our native oaks. Let's just, out of 91 species, we really don't need to go to China to find one.
Well, finally, I just love the underground stories that just seem to be so essential for us to understand. The things that are hidden from us sometimes can be the most important things to learn. And just the sheer scope, tell us the story. I don't know if it's legend or apocryphal, but the idea that in Scandinavia, people wanted to size up the extent of the root system.
Right. They were looking at the English oak. And so they decided they're going to dig it up. And they went in one direction. They followed the root system out, and they dug for 300 feet from the center part of the tree, and then they gave up. They never did hit the end of that root system. So the old adage that the roots of a tree go out to the drip line, they surely do, but they go far, much farther than that. And that's one of the reasons that our oaks aren't living 900 years these days, because where can you go 300 feet from the center of the tree before you hit a street or a sewer line or a foundation or something that blocks the growth of those roots? And that's what shortens the lifespan of our oaks. Many of us say, well, there's a 100-year oak. That's an old one. That's still a baby, and it's got a lot of growth that could happen if we treated those roots a little bit better.
Douglas Tallamy, author of The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. An archaeologist who looks not just down at the ground, but up into the sky, Alice Gorman, Dr. Space Junk. She's drawn to the study of most anything that we have put up into the sky in our space programs over the past 60-plus years. She is our next guest. You're listening to Constant Wonder.